So far, I've just been talking today about part one, 16 parts. Now I'm going to just go to part three. We'll talk some about part three. Starting in part three, we get, as it were, the second degree of refinement in the characterization of the myth of the given. So we want to look at subtler guises of it. And parts one and two have only been concerned with various forms of classical Cynthian theory. Skipping part two entirely for purposes of subtler, but it is very interesting. With part three, we want to widen our target range. Here's two features of the classical sense datum theory that have so far figured in the characterization of what it is to subscribe to the myth of the given. One is that the sensing of sense contents, as we saw last week, are taken by the classical sense datum theorists to be particulars. It's a sensory object. I'm having this patch here, that's my sense datum. So they're characterized as particulars. That's one of the things that caused so much trouble in step one, is how those could then entail facts of the form SSP. The further feature of the classical sense datum theorists is that the particulars themselves were taken to be inner episodes. They are sensory objects. They're things that happen in the inside of a person. They're events that take place, as it were, on the terminus side of a sensory interaction between a subject and an object. Those are two features of the classical conception of the sense theory, both of which Branham identifies with the very idea of the myth of the given. And starting in part three, in empiricism and philosophy of mind, Sellars wants to attack guises of the myth that make neither of those assumptions. So you could be falling into the myth of the given, even while insisting that the things that are given in a relevant sense are not particulars. Notice we need that to go after Lewis. Lewis thinks the crucial things that are given are quellia, which have instances that are universal. Secondly, and this I think is a point that still bears mentioning contemporary philosophy of perception, because most people have missed it. So all of Sellars' great followers, like Branham and Rorty and so on, completely missed this point in Sellars. It doesn't matter whether you think of them as inner or not. So Sellars thinks there's a lot of attack on the myth of the given. It's only attack on the idea of a certain kind of inner object. Whereas he thinks the crucial mistake, if it's diagnosed deeply enough, doesn't have to do with whether you think the crucial step that underwrites non-inferential beliefs involves tertia. I mention this because if you read Rorty's preface, it's all about the bad idea that there's an interface, or there's tertia. From Sellars' point of view, I think that's going to be a superficial Cartesian diagnosis of the problem. The problem is not whether you think it's about something inner or something outer, but how you characterize that. Merely moving the problem outward without changing its shape is not a way of getting around the myth of the given. It's going to be part of Sellars' point here. One thing. And second is, Sellars himself is not opposed to the idea of inner episodes. So you also give up something you need to have a good story. I might add here, just very parenthetically, that in this respect, I think, the reception of Sellars has been very parallel to the reception of Wittgenstein. I think most people think the point of the so-called private language sections of the investigations is to criticize some idea of the inner. If we just get rid of those episodes and only talk about public things as the basis of our beliefs, we've somehow avoided the problem. And I think it's just as much of a misreading. Wittgenstein and Sellars, writing only a couple years after the investigations was written, seems to realize that that is, in fact, a misreading of the opening sections of the investigations, as we'll see much later. But so that's just a way of saying how, in part three, we're trying to deepen the characterization of the myth. So many more views fall under its ambit than merely classical sense theory first. So Sellars begins part three by talking about an assumption which goes much further. She thinks lots and lots of people fall. And what she wants to suggest is already the mistake. That mistake is to think, this is quotation 12 in your handout, that the very idea of looking or appearing is to be analyzed in relational terms. So to a chair. There's a chair, there's me. The chair appears to me in a certain way, as blue. The object, the way it appears blue, there's me. Sounds pretty innocuous. Everyone assumes something like that. You can get rid of the idea that the crucial thing that appears is particular as opposed to qualia. You can think it's something inner or something outer that appears. But the idea that appearing is a relation, a triadic relation with the way it appears, the thing that appears, the thing it appears to, the subject, that lots of people hold. And Sellers is going to argue that that's already a mistake. The kind of view he comes up with this step in his view, is one that breaks the idea that this step is relational. It's relational. It involves what he calls picturing. Picturing involves a certain kind of isomorphic identity between the entities and the step. But there's no relation in which these things stand in a certain way to those things, element by element. So he thinks that's the crucial mistake. This is not part of our syllabus, but if you're interested, if you look at the third Woodbridge lecture by McDowell, that's the feature of Sellers' view that he's criticizing. So McDowell wants to sign on to a great deal of Sellers' criticism of the myth of the given. But McDowell thinks taking the very idea of intentionality or appearing as itself relational to be part of the myth, that's to go too far. That's to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Just a different way of marking how the parties in this debate come out in different places. You'll also notice, by the way, that I haven't put McDowell on the board. Make these drawings that are versions of each other's, but McDowell is not up there. You might think about why that is, and if you wanted to, as you read McDowell, if you wanted to draw McDowell's view, what would it look like? Would it be anything like the ones we have here? What would you keep, and what would you erase, and how would you rearrange? Just a little thing to puzzle over, which we'll come to in a few weeks. Okay, so Sellers is after this idea of appearing. So what he wants us to do is think hard about appearing, or looking. When we say something looks a certain way, what are we saying? And whatever else you think about Sellers, I think it's worth saying the following. If you're interested in philosophy of perception, which supposedly you are if you came to the seminar, you ought to be interested in this question about what it is for something to look or appear a certain way or smell a certain way. That seems like a pretty good topic. And one merit of Sellers is he really zeroes in on this topic. And some of what he's, the other person who really does it just a few years later is John Austin in Sense and Sensibility. And there's an interesting kind of convergence between some of what happens in that text and part three of EPM. Sellers asks us to consider the relationship between looks talk and is talk. So I can say things like, this looks blue. Let's just stick to colors for a moment. Obviously, there's all kinds of other ways things can look. Things can look to be square, they can look to be 10 feet away. They can look to be dangerous. But let's just start simple. This looks to be blue. That's one thing I can say about it. Another thing I can say about it is blue. Or it looks to be a chair. It is a chair. Those are two different kinds of things we can say about something present to us. And Sellers asks us to consider, what's the relationship between those two sorts of forms? Or those two sorts of utterances. Utterance about how things look. And utterance about how a thing is. He makes three points about this kind of quickly, which I'll try to slow down for you on page 35 and 6 of, I guess, this edition of EPM, the very beginning of part 3. he starts with what he calls the simple but fundamental. Oh, by the way, I sort of skipped this, but quotation 11 is his statement about how. The fundamental issue in the myth of the given is not one of public versus private, not whether it's an inner episode as opposed to something else, and therefore how getting rid of inner episodes does not get rid of the problem. I did actually read through the quotation, but another point I did provide it. Because it seems to me almost everyone who reads this reads past that, and therefore misses much of what he's doing. So now we're at 13, 14, and 15 in the handout. The relationship between looks talk and is talk. It starts with the following simple but fundamental point. The sense of red in which things look red is on the face of it the same as that in which things are red. Now let me take blue, since that's the color of my chair. So the first point here is, if I say this looks red, this looks blue, and I say this is blue, I'm using the word blue in the same sense. Blue is not a homonym. Very simple point. I'm not equivocating on the use of blue. If I say the First National Bank of Paris is on the left bank of the Seine, I am using the word bank in two different senses. But when I say this chair, which turns out to be blue, indeed looks blue in this light, I'm using the word blue in exactly the same sense. It's a very simple point, but it turns out to be quite powerful against certain kind of classical empiricism. Second point, when one glimpses an object and decides, let me put that first point slightly differently. Maybe let's put it this way. That suggests that if that's right, then I already understand what blue means in the claim the chair is blue. That sense of blue I already grasped. If I'm able to grasp a claim of the form, the chair looks blue. It's a different way of putting what I said. Spectrum one. But that way has the blade that cuts out front against the classical empiricist. So now 13. He says, I shall begin my examination of X looks red to S and T. But simple but fundamental point. I'm sorry, that's the one we just had. Next point, 14, second point. Is there a mistake in this handout? Yeah. I said first point twice, sorry. The first point is the second point. confusing myself. When one glimpses an object and decides that it looks red, to me now from here, and wonders whether it really is red, one is surely wondering whether the color red, which it looks to have, is the one it really does have. So now the point isn't just that when I say looks blue and I say it is blue, we're using the word in the same sense, but that these two claims stand in a kind of internal relation to each other. I'm just going to say more about this, but when I say it looks blue, that itself raises the question whether it is blue, without deciding the question that it is blue. So one of these claims is stronger than the other. It neither just entails the other, as we'll see. It can be blue without looking blue also. But that there's an intimacy between them. These aren't two different unrelated strata, the inner and the outer, which somehow then come together. And the third point, which is the one that is really destructive for traditional empiricism, which is that it won't do to say that X is red is analyzable in terms of X looks red. So, the point here now is that in traditional empiricism, something like that is exactly what people wanted to say. And the whole point of section 12 of EPM here at the beginning of part 3 is to strike deep into that epistemological tradition. I wish I'd put something like this in the handout. Here's something that, if I had been thinking, I would have put in the handout at this point. Let's give ourselves a preliminary definition of traditional empiricism so we can have a clear target before us. So let's say a traditional empiricism is a view that requires at least the following three assumptions. One, through the formulation of statements about how things appear, it's possible to form a class of statements that are epistemologically privileged. Usually, the sense in which they're epistemologically privileged in the mid-century was that they were incorrigible. I say things how things appear to me, or look to me, I can't be wrong about that. It's connected to a thought in Descartes' cogito. So the idea is, I start with those special statements about how things appear, and they look somehow more secure. So now we're going to build from those, and maybe we can justify knowledge. That was one claim, assumption of traditional empiricism. The second is that class of statements that's privileged, perhaps even incorrigible, represents the foundation of knowledge, the justificatory foundation. Everything else flows from there. So there's this architectural metaphor in which that's the basis. Those are the protocols, and as they like to say, in the middle of the century. And everything moves up from there. And statements about how things are based on an inference from statements about how things appear. This is a view you already have with Descartes. You have beginning with the early modern period. You can say how things appear to me, but in order to claim that I'm not dreaming, not to say how things seem, there's an inferential step to how things are. To claim about how things are, on that view, looks, if you will, logically posterior. It is derived from an inferential step from how things seem. Third assumption, the class of appearance statements, therefore, this is what's not often made explicit, but what matters, therefore, must be logically prior, or in some way conceptually prior, to the statements about how things are, if the former is the fundamental. And what's coming out of 13, 14, and 15, and 16 that you're handed is the way in which, if we think about the way in which looks, talk, and is talk are implicated, it doesn't look like we're going to be able to make sense of that assumption of traditional empiricism. Traditional empiricism. Let me just make a note about my vocabulary. I'm saying traditional empiricism. I'm not saying empiricism. That is, the essay is called Empiricism and the Philosophy of Mind. Brandon's commentary suggests it should be called Empiricism versus the Philosophy of Mind. That is, he thinks empiricism is just a bad idea. It's summarized by something like this. Sellers is against it. I think Sellers thinks he's an empiricist. So some of his followers, notably Rorty and Brandon, thinks what Sellers has shown us is empiricism is a bad idea. Others of his followers, like McDowell, think empiricism is a good idea, but we have to find a way of being empiricist without falling to the trap of traditional empiricism. Although I think Sellers is nowhere near as close to McDowell as McDowell thinks he is. That much is also true of Sellers. I think Sellers is trying to vindicate the truth in empiricism while avoiding the problems of traditional empiricism. So I'm using the label traditional empiricism here advisedly as the target of the book, but not one that necessarily exhausts what empiricism comes to. Come back to that next time, probably. So Sellers thinks that what his reflections in section 12, some of which are summarized for you in the handout, suggest, in fact, the opposite conclusion. Not that the fundamental notion is looking, and out of that we can derive claims about how things are from how they look, but rather that if we just think about the logical structure of the locutions we want to use and what it would take to learn either, actually, the logically or conceptually prior, he uses those two locutions interchangeably, logically prior and conceptually prior, locution is the one about how things are. To say something looks red presupposes an understanding of what it is to claim that something is red, but says more than that. It's actually logically a quite complicated claim you're making when you claim something looks red. It's not a simple claim, the way in which this Cartesian picture invites you to think it's layer one. Rather, if you analyze the logical structure of what's said, we realize that this is logically quite articulate. And part of what we need to understand and part of what part three is about is the analysis of looks talk. What is the logical structure of looks talk? How does it stand in relation to is talk? But before we go to that, we will start talking about that, the logical structure of looks talk, in a moment. Let me point out something else, which is what Sellers calls a troubling situation. This is exactly the kind of thing that the Neo-Sellersian method said. Neo-Sellersians will, at this point, just start cheering. They'll say, yay, we've seen that looks talk's a bad idea, is talk is prior, let's junk looks talk. And we'll see the exact way in which they want to junk in a moment. Whereas Sellers moves much more slowly at this point and says, although I do think that looks talk is logically derivative and in a certain way conceptually parasitic on is talk, nevertheless, point 17 in the handout is true. And at point 17 in the handout is true, that creates a troubling situation, what Sellers calls a troubling situation, which is how to square the insight that is talk is more fundamental than looks talk, but this, that X is red, and then we have this remark for logical implication in Sellers. It's not exactly clear how to read this remark. I don't think it's simply logical implication, but I'll just read it for the moment as if and only if. X is red if and only if X would look red to standard observers in standard situations. So Sellers is noticing that, at least for what we might call secondary quality concepts, concepts like red, the conception of how things look is part of the concept. If nobody had, as it were, visual sensoria, there would be no occasion to use the concept red. So that, but now, it's also kind of tricky. There's two normative constraints. Things that are red don't look red in any circumstances. They have to look red under the appropriate circumstances, or as you call them, your standard circumstances. And secondly, they don't look red to anybody, even in standard circumstances. You have to be the appropriate kind of observer, not colorblind, various other things. So, given the right kind of observer, in the right kind of circumstances, two degrees of normative constraint there, you can see a red thing as red, and what it is for it to be red is for it to look red under those conditions. That's an incredibly complicated concept, part of the elucidation of which, the elucidation of the concept red, makes use of the notion of how it looks. So he wants to say, yes, the notion of looks is logically more complicated than the notion of is, but a full explication of what it is to be red, as opposed to, say, square or 6 feet away, involves this other complication that how things look under certain circumstances is part of the articulation of it. We need to hold both those things together, hence the troubling situation. How do you do this? In 19, he suggests that to get out of the troubling situation takes two steps. The first step is the one that I already advertised, and the one that McDowell thinks is going off the deep end, which is to give up on the idea that looking is a relation at all. It's connected to this feature of Sellers' view, which I just point at for the moment. What I mostly want to look at is what Sellers describes as the second step, which you also need to perform to get out of the troubling situation, which is the one he performs first in part three, and which has been very influential, even if people haven't noticed how it fits into the larger architectonic of the essay. They have noticed it. And it's partly they've noticed it because he tells this famous story of the parable of the tie shop, which is sufficiently eye-catching that people notice the story and what he says about it, without noticing that it's only the second step of a two-step process for avoiding the troubling situation. So now we come to the parable of the tie shop. Shall we read it together? To bring out the essential features of the use of looks, this is number 20 in the handout, I shall engage in a little historical fiction. A young man, whom I shall call John, works in a necktie shop. He has learned the use of color words in the usual way, with this exception. I shall suppose that he has never looked at an object in other than standard conditions. If time allowed, we might ask ourselves exactly what it is to imagine that. But let's just let it have it for a moment. As he examines his stock every evening, closing up shop, John says, this is red, that is green, this is purple, etc. And such of his linguistic peers as happen to be present nod their heads approvingly. This is a rather strange community. Let us suppose now that at this point in the story, electric lighting has been invented. So until now, the shop closes when it goes dark. The light in it is sunlight. They only have natural lighting. But now, dun-dun-dun, electric lighting is invented. His friends and neighbors, being less traditional than John, rapidly adopt this new means of illumination and wrestle with the problems it presents. We'll see what these are in a moment. John, however, slow guy in the block, is the last to succumb. Finally, though, John, too, gets electrical lighting. He installs these light bulbs. This is the early days of electrical lighting, so the light is kind of yellowish. I think this is part of what we're being told here. This is written in the 50s when that's a matter of memories, everyone still. So we have this yellowish light. And one of his neighbors, the hero of our story, appropriately called Jim, comes in to buy a necktie. Here's a handsome green one, says John. But it isn't green, says Jim. He takes John outside, into the sunlight. Well, John says, it was green in there, but now it's blue. No, says John, you know that neckties don't just change their color. merely as a result of being taken from place to place. But perhaps electricity changes their color, and they change it back again in daylight. So John is here construing the change as a change of state in the object, as opposed to what we might call a change in its appearance. That would be a queer kind of change, wouldn't it, says Jim? I suppose so, says bewildered John. But we saw that it was green in there. One of the topics of this section is the grammar of not just looking, but seeing, and how their grammar is different. We get a little lesson in the grammar of seeing from Jim now. Now, we did see that it was green in there, because it wasn't green, and you can't see what isn't so. Oh, well, this is a pretty pickle, says John. I just don't know what to say. The next time John picks up his tie in his shop, and someone asks what color it is, his first impulse is, of course, to say how things look. It's green. He suppresses this impulse. That sentence, sort of taken out of context, impresses the hell out of Branham. Branham's whole reading of this comes out of that sentence, but my point is there. He suppresses this impulse. And remembering what happened before, John comes out with, it's blue. So his impulse is to say it's green, Branham will say. But it's not what he said, because he wants to state a fact. And he thinks the true fact is it's blue. So he suppresses the impulse to say it's green and says, it's blue. He doesn't see that it's blue. This is what Branham utterly misses, I think. There's a difference between knowing it's blue for certain reasons and also seeing that it's blue. Shall we say, knowing it on the basis of one's perceptual experience. You need that idea in order to make sense of this idea. But experience is not one of Branham's words. Branham does not want it to be one of Sellers' words. He doesn't see that it's blue, nor would he say that he sees it to be blue. Well, what does, at this point in our story, John see? Let's ask him. I don't know what to say. If I didn't know that the tie is blue, and I admit the alternative to Granny is very odd indeed, I would swear that I was seeing a green tie, and indeed seeing it to be green. It is as though I were seeing the necktie to be green. If we bear in mind that such sentences as, this is green, have both a fact-stating and a reporting use, we can put the point I have in mind, I'll continue in a moment. So now we get a distinction in Sellers between a fact-stating and a reporting use. This is how I understand Sellers' distinction. It's not how Rorty or Brandon read this. They have to create a different distinction to get that reading. I understand it like this. When John, standing in the tie shop, seeing something that looks to be green, says it's blue, that's a fact stating. That's a mere, we could say, merely fact stating use of this is blue. Blue does not describe what he sees or how things look, but it does describe the fact as to the color of the tie. That's the fact stating use in this story. If John sees the tie to be blue, as he does when he goes outside, then he's not merely stating a fact about how things are with the tie when he says it's blue. He's also reporting the blue he can see in saying that it is blue. So that's a reporting use of blue. But that's not the only kind of reporting use of blue, one in which you say what you see for Sellers. I'll tell you why in a moment. But I just wanted to first get the distinction clear, because how to unpack this distinction between fact stating and reporting might sound like a small matter, involves taking very different terms in your philosophy of perception at this point. It's connected to what you think is going on in the middle of the board, depending upon who you are. Hence my inclination to go very slow at this point in the parable. Back to the parable. If we bear in mind that sentences such as this is green can have both a fact stating and a reporting use, we've had examples of both, as I've just explained in the parable so far, we can put the point I have just been making by saying that once John learns to stifle the report, this next tie is green. When he wants to report how things seem to be based on what he can see, he wants to say this is green. But he stifles that, the report. Then there's no other report about color in the necktie which he knows how to make. He can say what color it is, blue, based on something he knows. And he can infer from that to what the color is. But it's not a report. It's not based on his experience, we might say. The idea that Brandon wants to throw away, but which I think we need in order to understand Sellars' conception of the difference between fact stating and reporting uses. To be sure, he now says the necktie is blue. But he's not making a reporting use of this sentence. When he says the necktie is blue, he's just stating a fact about the necktie. If we were to draw conclusions about how things look to him based on this alone, we would draw false conclusions. The necktie is blue, for John, is the conclusion of an inference based on his past experience, and what color things really are when they look green in the tie shop. It's based on inference, not on a report. So that's Sellars' way of drawing the distinction. I'm trying to do it as slowly and carefully as I can to kind of burn it into your mind for a moment. Yeah. Let's look at quotation 16. This is Sellars going on from the parable. Let me begin by noting that there certainly seems to be something to the idea that the sentence, "This looks green to me now," has a reporting role. So now Sellars is here expanding the notion of report beyond what I said so far. The first notion of report I explained is when it's blue, and you see it's blue, you can report that it's blue. But now we're back in the tie shop, where the blue tie looks green. And another thing you can report about, if you will, how things are with you in your relation to the tie, as opposed to how things simply are as a matter of fact with respect to the tie. Another thing you can report is, as he says here, this looks green to me now. Not said what color it is. It was said what color it looks to be. That's another reporting use of language. So reports include statements about how things are, based on what we can see, but also statements about how things look, regardless of how they are. And if this wasn't true, you'd have a lot of trouble with the eye doctors. You go to the eye doctors and he asks you questions. He just wants to tell you how it looks. And he switches the lens and says, and now how does it look? And then how does it look? And you would not be very helpful if you got a good look at that chart before you started, and you just told them what you were actually seeing at each point. You come out with a really bad pair of lenses. You want to be able to say how things look to you, as well as how things are to you. And you can report that. And the eye doctors is a very special case in which we're interested in the one almost to the exclusion of the other. Usually, of course, we're interested in the one partly because we're interested in the other. So, quotation 16, there certainly seems to be something to the idea. The sense, this looks green to me now, is a reporting role. Indeed, it would seem to be essentially a report. So the idea is here, we're reporting something without stating a fact. So some reporting uses help us arrive at facts about how things are. But when we're at the eye doctors, we can be reporting things, saying things like, actually, doc, now it looks like a W. Or I don't mean to be telling you what the letter is, I just mean to be telling you just how bad my sight is at this point. But if so, if there are such reporting uses where we say how things look, where how things look comes apart from how things are, what? Sellars is italics. What does it report? What does it report? If not a minimal objective fact about how things are, and if what it reports is not to be analyzed in terms of sense data. So we can engage in such reports about how things look that are not reports of facts. And we want to avoid them if they're given. So this is the difficulty. There is such a thing as talking about appearances, how things look to us. And doing that truthfully and getting the right prescription in the eye doctor depends upon being very truthful about it, up to a very high degree of discrimination. But what are you reporting, if not a fact, and we don't want to stick something here that winds up falling prey to the myth? What do we do? That's Sellers' problem. In the parable of Tyshop, that he's trying to make urgent. Very different from the conclusion we'll see next week that these people draw from the parable of Tyshop. And we'll see how they manage to draw exactly how the misreading happens. Okay, now, let's begin to watch the misreading happen by looking at Brandon. So we're already moving into the material for next week. I want to do this a little bit so that when you go back and read Brandon, both the study guide and the Brandon reading for next week, you can start to try to actually press the facts and see where the rabbit's pulled out of the hat. It's very artfully done. So look at quotation 17. This is the first thing Brandon says in his study guide when he's summarizing the parable of Tyshop. One of the first things he says is, sentences can have reporting, parentheses, non-inferential uses, as well as merely fact-stating inferential uses. Now the difference between non-inferential and inferential beliefs, or non-inferential and inferential uses of language, is a Szilárdi distinction. No doubt about that. We talked about it last week. It's in the first paragraph of the essay, as we saw last week. But Brandon wants to explain the distinction that's being introduced many pages later, after the Tyshop in part 3, between reporting and fact stating uses, as if it were just different terminology for that same distinction again. Whereas I'm claiming it's not. Sellers has drawn a different distinction at this point. The difference between fact stating and reporting uses cannot simply be assimilated to this distinction. Because not all reporting uses, as we just saw, are cases of making a non-inferential claim about how things are. If I say it looks red to me, I don't therefore have a non-inferential belief about how something is. It's being red. Or say green, the touch. If I do, it's one that I haven't stated yet, namely that it's blue. So one thing Brandon does is he just collapses these two pieces of terminology so he gets things to come out the way he wants. Other things that Brandon does is he starts complaining about Sellers. He notices that Sellers' way of talking doesn't seem to be explaining Sellers' views very well, given what he thinks Sellers' views are supposed to be. So he has various kinds of complaints. But one of them is he complains about his terminology. His terminology is strained, he says in quotation 18. There's no reason to deny that non-inferential reports are in the fact-stating line of work. But Sellers is not denying that a non-inferential report about what you see is in a fact-stating line of work. What he's denying is a non-inferential report about how things merely look. He's in a fact-stating line of work. But Brandon doesn't see that there is that kind of a report. So he misses what Sellers is doing. Brandon says, the preferred usage is to see the distinction between claims that are non-inferential and those that arrive as conclusions and inferences as a distinction within fact-stating discourse. Well, that's all fine with Sellers. That's all over here. But that's again to assimilate the other distinction to this one and assume he must be repeating it. Because if he isn't, he's introducing a role for experience that Brandon both doesn't want experience to have, which he thinks his teacher Sellers has taught us it shouldn't have. So again, that was very fast. But I encourage you to go back and look at the Sellers and study guide. And I think if you read it slowly, you'll see that Brandon and Sellers at this point really start coming radically apart. And they never get together again. Sellers is off worrying about things that Brandon would not have been worried about for the other 14 16ths of the study guide. Okay, I'll say a few more things. And then we can continue next week. Let me just point you towards quotation 21. I'll just skip some material we can come back to next time. But this is just to sort of set up the way in which Sellars' own views are nothing like those of the neo-Solarsians, the left-wing Solarsians, Davidson, Brandon, and Rorty will be talking about next week. So let's look at quotation 21. Let's next call attention to the fact. Let's next call attention to the fact that the experience of having something look green to one at a certain time is, insofar as an experience, something very much like that of seeing something to be green, insofar as the latter is an experience. Notice, first of all, this is rather a simple point, but the word experience is pretty important here. Try to write the sentence without it. Experience is one of Sellars' words. Indeed, what he says at the end of this quotation is that what he wants to do is to put the way of talking about experience that he engages in this quotation, in quotation 21, on the gold standard. Give us a way of talking about it that will allow it to circulate, to have genuine semantic exchange value. That is, find a way to talk about experience where he can say these things without falling into the myth, which is suggested is a rather complicated task for him. The latter, seeing something to be green, of course, is not just an experience. When you see something to be green, you're not just reporting about how things look to you. You're making a claim about the world. It's not just an experience. And this is the heart of the matter. For to say that a certain experience is a seeing that something is the case, to say of an experience that it's a seeing, is to do more than describe the experience. Something Sellars wants to claim, which we'll look at the beginning of next week, following Ryle, is that see is an achievement verb. To see something is something you can fail or not fail to do. Not every case in which you take yourself to be seeing something when you report out this look is a seeing. Things actually have to be as reported for it to be seen. Seeing is, in that respect, like knowing. But although a certain experience is a seeing, in order to say that we see such and such, that's to do more than describe the experience. Notice here, he does have room for the following idea. He takes it for obvious. He's not arguing for it. But notice in passing, he has room for this idea. There is also something other than saying what you see, which is describing the experience. That's exactly what the left-wing Solarsians are going to explore. They don't see how there can be a topic which can be described like this, describing your experiences, which is something different than getting right how things are, without falling into the myth. In fact, Brandom and Rorty and most of the left-wing Solarsians think Sellars himself taught us there cannot be such a thing. Whereas the topic of this quotation is precisely to argue there must be such a thing. And it's the goal of the rest of my essay to try to make sense of it. So, saying that a certain experience is a seeing that something is the case is to do more than describe the experience. It is to characterize it as, about five lines down now, so to speak, making an assertion or a claim. And, this is the point I wish to stress, to endorse that claim. So when I say that I see that something is red, I'm doing something very complicated, Sellars says. First, among other things, I'm characterizing my experience. Secondly, in characterizing my experience, I am ascribing a claim to my experience. My experience itself contains the claim. The chair is blue. And I am endorsing the claim that my experience contains. All of that's going on. Those are different logical moments of what a report of what I see involves. And what happens, we'll see in the Neo-Solarsians, is they see half of this is going on without the other half. That is, the idea that when I talk about looks talk, as opposed to sees thought, I'm not endorsing the content of what I said. They like that. So, Sellers will go on, we'll see this next time, to analyze Luke's talk as being logically more complicated than his talk or C's talk, in that it involves the withholdment of an endorsement. If I say the chair looks blue to me now, I'm saying I'm having an experience of it in which it appears to be blue, and I'm withholding endorsement of that claim. So Luke's talk is actually logically very complicated and utterly derivative on his talk. And we have to borrow Wittgenstein's way of putting things, master the grammar of his talk in order to engage in Luke's talk. Because if you don't have the content of what you're endorsing, what you're withholding endorsement from, you can't withhold it. The Neo-Salazians like that part of it. But what they miss, or what they're determined to miss, is that what I'm withholding endorsement from is not just some claim I find myself inclined to make. We'll see how Brandon tries to tell a story about how I'm inclined to make this claim, where that comes from. It's not what I'm withholding endorsement from, some claim I'm inclined to make. I'm withholding endorsement from a claim my experience itself contains. A correct characterization of my experience, if I were at the eye doctor, would involve coming out with the words that characterize such a claim, whether I endorse the claim or not. One of the things I can do in expressing myself well is express myself accurately about what I'm experiencing, even when I know there's a mismatch between my experience and the world. So what we'll do next time is we'll keep reading section 21. Quotation 21 in your handout. If we kept reading it, I stopped it quite early. If we kept reading it, we'd find the following. That Sellers actually gives in that quotation towards the end of it quite a good characterization of the left-wing Salazian view and says, but surely this is not enough to say. The crucial thing that's missing is the idea that experience can contain claims. That looks to him like a very hard thing to be able to say without falling into the beginning. These guys agree with that. Therefore, they just want to build a wall here. Sellers' aim is to try to vindicate the idea of experience containing claims. That's the bit of Sellers we'll later see McDowell likes. Though I think McDowell misses that Sellers' way of doing this is nothing like his own. So that's one thing we'll see next time. Next thing we'll look at next time is how it is that the Neo-Salazians themselves understand Sellers and what kind of view they construct on the basis of that. And the third thing we'll look at is what this means about what empiricism is in the 20th century. To what extent can one be an empiricist and still accept Sellers' arguments in the first part of EPM? The conclusion of many people nowadays is that empiricism itself leads directly into the trap of the myth of the given. That's, I think, the more popular view, which various people defend in various ways of avoid. Another possibility is to say, no, we need to save what we might call the truth in empiricism while avoiding the myth of the given. I think in different ways, Sellers and McDowell, but I think their views are quite different, both represent an attempt to do that. So those are the kinds of issues we'll discuss next week. See you next week.